Here's to us.
Who's like us? Damn few.
Hey, theater people, Patrick here. Well, here it is, you guys, the 100th episode of the Theater People podcast, which we recorded live at Broadway Con. I don't really know what to say, and I don't want to make this into a long, sappy intro, so let me just say that I love making this podcast. Next to my daughter and my husband and, you know, the rest of my family, I don't think I love anything more in the world than talking to these brilliant theater people and then sharing our conversations with you, our listeners. So for our 100th episode, I assembled some of our all-time favorite guests: Daisy Egan, Kayala Settle, Beth Malone, Andrew Keenan-Bolger, and Celia Keenan-Bolger, sort of just to catch up, but really to tell them what they've meant to me and to this podcast and why. So, without any further ado, here's our conversation.
So, old friend, fill me in slow. Old friend, start from hello. Old friend.
Welcome. Hi, famous people. You guys, thank you all for coming. I'm so excited to be here with these people. There's two Keenan-Bolger sitting next to each other on this stage. And I met Maggie for the first time in the green room the other day, and I basically got on my knees and just, like, bowed down in front of her. Maggie is the most incredible. So this is the 100th episode of the Theater People podcast, you guys. So we did a collection of our favorite guests, and I'm sorry, you guys, but you're going to have to listen to me gush about you each, and we're going to go down the row. We're going to start with Andrew. Andrew Keenan-Bolger, you guys. It's not just, like, handsome and talented, but he was, I want to say your episode was, like, 13 or 14. It was really early on. And we were so new. We didn't know what we were doing. And it was, the actual episode was so badly produced that we put it up and then we had to take it down. Because it was unlistenable. So we had to, like, refix it and put it together. But one of the things I've never forgotten was one of the reasons I love you so much and I'm such a big fan was because of Submissions Only. So you all know Submissions Only. The thing that I didn't know about Submissions Only was that Andrew went into it not knowing a lot of how to make it. And you wouldn't know that because it's so well made. And so when you came and we were like, had no idea even how to put our equipment together. We're like, Andrew will know. He'll know how to do this. And then you gave us this like amazing pep talk about like, just do it. Don't worry how it sounds. Don't worry like what's going on with it. Just like do it and make it and you'll figure it out. And that is one of the things that helped get us to 100 episodes, and I'm so grateful. So thank you. So Andrew has a lot going on, of course, because he's Andrew Keenan-Bolger. One of the things I never got to ask you about was Tuck Everlasting, which I love. I hate to ask your sister to do anything, but will you slide the mic over so he can talk? You guys, it's Celia Keenan-Bolger! Okay. Tuck Everlasting is, I just got to interview Michael Park a few weeks ago, and I will freak out about anybody who was in Tuck, because did you guys see Tuck Everlasting?
Yes!
Okay. Oh. I love that musical so much. Two of the things that stand out to me are the fact that you, as an actor, are, like, climbing the set, your incredible set, and, like, it was the most amazing, and also the fact that your musical, the last 15 minutes was just music. And I remember, like, my husband is here, and we have a kid. We have, like, now a three-year-old daughter. I just sobbed the entire time. I'm just going to ask you to reflect on the experience. Like, what an incredible show, and how was it for you?
Thank you. I mean, it was one of those things that I got to develop from the beginning, and it was a really long road to Broadway. And ultimately, it was not a commercial success, but I mean, just being here has been really great. There have been so many people who have come up and said that it is a musical that really affected them. I mean, I even have, you can't see it on the podcast, but these little stickers that people made for Tuck. And the fact that it had that impact is really great.
Yeah. I wanted to talk, too, about, so we talked the other day about this, but not in front of these people, about Newsies. So Newsies is doing a live capture film, and I don't know the dates off the top of my head, but it's going to be in theaters.
February 16th, 18th, and 22nd. Fathomevents.com for tickets.
So the show was such a phenomenon that they're like capturing it on film with their favorite Newsies of all time. Of course, Andrew's back. How was it for you to get to revisit it and do it again?
It was amazing. It was also a little weird. First of all, I am now like twice the age of my character. So I was a little nervous about close-ups. I'm like, just put a little more dirt around the eyes, right on the forehead where the wrinkles are.
Yeah, Andrew really needs to worry about the close-ups.
But it was incredible. I think every actor dreams of getting a redo at a role. Daisy Egan. And to be in a show that was really important to get another chance at it. And I think especially to preserve it. Because one of the great joys of being on Broadway is that you can, I guess it's not a joy, you can never sit outside and watch yourself from the front. So I'm
true.
Going to see things in Newsies that I'll have no idea that there was a projection behind me that was doing that.
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. You get a new song. So your character is Crutchy. Mm-hmm. So I don't know about you guys. Probably none of you are old enough to even know this, but I was such a Newsy nerd for the 92 film. Like, I was that little gay. Did you guys see the movie? Mm-hmm. So, Crutchy, of course, had I think probably a little bit more to do in that version of the movie, but yeah. Now you get a new song. So Crutchy gets a new song. That's reason enough to go see the movie. What is the song, and like, how was it to get to like even get to build on your character?
Yeah, well, it's this beautiful song that takes place in Act 2 after Crutchy is carried off to the refuge, which is the jail for young kids. And he writes Jack Kelly a letter. The song is called Letter from the Refuge. And it's a beautiful, sweet moment. You know, that musical is so about energy and, like, dancing and, like, crazy human body pyrotechnics. So the fact that there is one really small moment in it, I think it's a little bit of a breath. And you get to see the vulnerability of one of the characters that you had never seen before and that didn't really exist in the musical. So I'm so glad that they put it in. I'm so glad I got a chance to sing it.
Yeah. I love you. Thank you for coming and doing this.
I love you too, Betsy.
Andrew had to be on like 4 of my panels this weekend, so I feel like we've gotten to know each other over the course of
no,
these two
it's
days.
The goods. Celia and I, we always talk about doing theater people because you're one of the most knowledgeable people.
Are you kidding me?
Yes. We've talked about it like very many times.
What?
Because you do these press things, and sometimes, I mean, I remember when I was in Spelling Bee on tour, and people would be like, at a local radio station, they say, so, you won a spelling bee.
Yeah, Aaron Keenan Bolger.
Yes, truly. The fact that you have such love for this industry and really spend the work to really get to know your guests, and we get to talk about stuff that we would never talk about on anyone
yes.
else's show. We love it.
You guys, I challenge the rest of my guests to say something nicer.
Google.com.
Yeah. All right, I'm going down to my sister from another mister. Tony winner Daisy Egan, you guys. Hey, girl.
Hi.
So one of the reasons that you're one of my favorite guests is because you're one of my favorite people.
Aww.
I love you so much.
I love you.
I love that our kids get to play together and that they're growing up knowing each other. That we are literally just telling people that Daisy is the birth mother.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. At this point.
I birthed Daisy.
Yes. Thank you for that. Yeah. But she was like, you got to give her the same name.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I'm a terrible Jew in that sense. But I'm a terrible Jew generally. So
we were walking around the marketplace yesterday and my Daisy had not had a nap yet. And so all she wanted was Daisy.
Yeah,
she
would
wanted
not
neither of
let
her parents.
You guys touch her.
No.
And like, literally, they were, like, trying to get her hair out of her face, and she was like, and then, like, cuddling into me, and I was like, I get it.
One of the funniest things that ever happened, my best friend and producer, Mike Jensen, is here, you guys. Producer Mike! So Mike will tell... Oh, he hates it when we talk about him. But Mike will tell this hilarious story about how he was telling a story to somebody else about how I was on the subway with Daisy and how she was throwing a tantrum and she didn't want to talk to anybody and then she threw herself on the floor and we were talking about my daughter, but the person thought we were talking about Daisy Egan. And we just, like, let it stand. We're like, yeah she was in a bad mood.
And that person was like, oh, yeah, I've seen her do that.
Yeah, she's like, this is about right. Yeah. So
do not look her in the eye.
One of the greatest joys, one of my greatest theater-going joys of the last year was getting to see you do The Secret Garden in D.C.
If
any of you don't know, Daisy Egan won a Tony Award when she was 11 years old. She's the youngest female Tony Award winner. She'll tell you anytime. I'm just kidding. For originating the role of Mary Lennox in The Secret Garden. I feel like over the years, people have been trying to coerce you to come back into the show in various roles and various incarnations of it. But for the Lincoln Center revival or the Lincoln Center concert that they did last year, you did it. You went.
So I was sitting on your couch hanging out. I won't tell the details of why I was there. because it will embarrass you.
It will embarrass. We won't talk about it.
We were fully clothed. And you said, did you hear they hired Sydney Lucas to play Mary in this concert version of Secret Garden? And I hadn't heard anything about it. And I picked up my phone and called my agent, and I was like, so here's the deal. I need to be in that, and you need to make that happen. And then I just, like, launched, like, clandestine Twitter campaigns.
Yes.
Like, I had you put out a thing that was like, wouldn't it be neat if Daisy Egan was in the, you know, the concert?
I mean, I was campaigning pretty hard, too.
Yeah, and then, like, Playbill picked it up.
Yeah.
And then I was like, hold on, guys, I might have some news. You know what I mean? Just, like...
Her
really
character sings a song called Hold On, You Guys.
Shameless.
It's a layered joke.
And then I was doing an interview with Lucy and Marcia and Rebecca Luker for another concert that was happening. And they'd brought up the Lincoln Center concert, and I said, have you cast Martha yet? Because that's, you know, professional thing to do. And they said no. And I basically threw myself at them. I threw myself at them. And I said, oh, I know the perfect Martha. And they literally go, who? And I was like, Celia Keenan Bolger, you guys. Come on. And
that's no laugh. I don't joke about Celia Keenan Bolger.
No,
we
don't
laugh about her.
Joke about her. She will take you down.
Yeah.
And Lucy was like, can you sing it? And I was like... yes, I think so. And so I was going to audition for them. Thank God I didn't have to, because I am the world's worst auditioner. The world's worst. But Michael Cosrin, like, just went on YouTube and looked me up, and they gave me the role. And my life changed, you guys.
So you did it at Lincoln Center. Now, I remember, I always say that, like, it was Bear City at Lincoln Center.
It was
every bear in New York
was
there to see you do it.
Yeah.
And it was like, you came out on the stage, and not even for your song, and it was like thunderous, rapturous entrance applause.
It was neat.
Yeah. So how was it to get to revisit it in that, and then how is it to get to be doing it now? You just finished your run in D.C., you're going to Fifth Ave in Seattle, and then maybe locally.
Yeah.
Like a local production.
If they can, yeah.
Social media, go.
Yeah, exactly. It's a little community theater in Brooklyn we're going to do it at. Anyway. What?
How? Oh. Are you having a good time is basically what I'm asking.
Always.
Yeah.
I was terrified. Thank God for beta blockers. I'm telling you, they saved my career. It was incredible, and it was like my first time back on a stage in New York in any significant like venue and in a really long time, and I had spent a lot of my teen years giving like really bad performances in New York. So in my mind, like everyone in New York was like, Daisy Egan is the worst. In reality, they were like, I don't think about Daisy Egan on a regular basis. Which is the correct way to live your life. And so I was mortified, and I got really sick the first day of rehearsal, and was very sick the whole time. But I took a beta blocker and prayed to a god I don't believe in, and the Lord of the universe saved me, and it was amazing, and it was incredible, and I was like out there like singing to myself, and like going back and like healing that part of myself, because you know my mom was very ill when I was doing Secret Garden, and she died like a year after I left the show. And I was fortunate enough to be in a position at that point in my life where I got to have somebody sing,
yeah,
like, hold on to me every night, you know, which...
I got to talk to Alison Fraser about that on the podcast. It was fine.
Okay.
She was very, like, it was, you know... So I do another podcast called Broadway Backstory, and we did an episode on The Secret Garden, and I got to talk to everybody involved in the creative process. Not only did everybody talk about you as, like, a creative genius, but, like, everybody talked about, like, the band of women that, like, took care of you during that time, and how, for Allison, that was so, I don't know if healing is the right word, but very cathartic that she got to, like, be there with you in that moment 8 times a week.
I was really lucky. Like, if your mom is going to die, like, that's the situation you want to be in, is to have somebody every night being like, this is going to be okay. You're going to get through it. It's your only option is to get through. So now for me to get to turn around and sing that song is a way for me to kind of go back and like sort of close that chapter of my life, which really needed to happen. because it was 25 years ago, and like open a new chapter. And also, I'm political, so I just have to be political. Given the times that we're in right now, for me to get to say, when you see a man who's raging and he's jealous and he fears that you've walked through walls he's hid behind for years, what you do then is you tell yourself to wait it out. Like, for me to get to say that, just even for myself, is gonna get me through this next 4 years.
Hi, Kayala Settle.
Thank you for coming. Tell me what they're thinking, ladies and gentlemen. Enjoy your next panel, whatever that is.
Hi, love.
Hi. I just want to start out by saying I just gave Beth Malone a hug and said I loved you in Pocahontas. Not alternative facts. I've also tweeted it just so I could totally make myself fail. Get that out of the way.
First of all, I see you on the subway all the time because we live in the same neighborhood.
That's right. Don't tell anybody.
I know. Sorry. But you guys don't know where I live. One of the reasons that you're one of my favorite guests, it just goes without saying. Like, your episode of our podcast was so raw and emotional and real. And, like, it is one of the things that that people talk to me about the most. Whenever they meet me and they know that I host theater people, they ask about your episode. Because it was just, like, so, you were just so there. Like, you were just there to tell your story and, like, offer advice and sort of talk about what you went through. And are you just always an open book like that?
Yes.
What do you guys want to know? No, I'm just kidding.
Well, funny that you should mention that. You were telling the story about when your mother passed away during that time. And I just left Waitress.
Yeah.
And during our out-of-town tryout, my mother passed away. And I didn't know if I wanted to keep going. And everybody there looked after me and said, well, you need to. There's really no question. And since then have become very, very close. I'm very, very close with Jesse Mueller, very close with Jenna Ushkowitz and Eric Anderson. We're one of the, and I'm working with him right now, actually. It's a very tight-knit family that looked after me as well and that I now get to take with me throughout the rest of my life. And it's a blessing. I'm grateful for it.
I have not gotten to talk to you really about Waitress yet, at least in front of all these people. Aww. Yeah. How was it to get to create that amazing role and that amazing show? And, like, to work with Sarah Bareilles, who isn't or wasn't up until that point a musical theater writer, what a special, spectacular show, and how was it to get to create that role in it?
To be able to create these three strong women that really were very humble in their own right, so to speak. We weren't really we weren't coming out as like Marvel characters of any kind. We were just exactly. Or any of those people. That's right, in Hamilton. Because nobody else can be, let's be honest. We were just these, three chicks working at a diner and living real life. And as we were working through these characters and seeing how the core dealt with one another, and tried to figure out how each person worked and who looked after who and who needed the help, who needed to be pulled out of the dark, who needed to be lifted into the light, all that stuff. We sort of figured each other out. And I guess that's how, I think with any good production, you can't really do it by yourself. I mean, I double dog dare you, it's not going to work. But you have to kind of lean on each other to create this story. And that's how we did it. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And even off stage, we are still those people. Jesse is still one of those people that's like, I'm going to fix it. And I'm going, girl, you ain't going to fix it, and it's okay. It's all right, you can't fix it. And Jenna's just like, guys, where are we going tonight? So we still are those people off stage and look after one another, to this day. I mean, I just texted him last night. They're like, we miss you. We wish you could come out tonight. Like, I can't. I got to be here.
I wanted to talk a little bit about, like, there was a lot of discussion around the fact that you guys were the first all-female creative team. And actually, Daisy, when I was talking to the creative team in Secret Garden, that was a 90% female creative team. How was that different for you? How was that different for you than other experiences you've been in?
Well, I will say it was amazing. I will also say every now and then you needed a man. You just needed a man in there because there are, as powerful as we are as women, we are powerful as women. So everybody's going to go off on somebody every 5 seconds and then walk away and go, don't talk to me, don't touch me. And then everybody's trying to figure out who's on whose schedule for the time of the month and all that stuff. And then you just throw hormones in it. So you kind of need somebody to break that up and come in and go, yeah, let's just, how about let's take a 10? You know, it just, you need something. Not that guys are dumb. You just need somebody else who's not in there overthinking something.
Yeah.
And for us, because there were so many strong personalities that had so many amazing ideas, we were literally killing each other with them. So by the end of every night, we were going, I can't do this, I can't do this, I can't do this. And then the next day, starting all over again.
I love you so much.
Love you.
We're not done with the questions, but I'm going to move on to Beth Malone.
Yay!
Beth Malone!
Not Pocahontas, guys.
Hi, Beth Malone.
Hi.
I also loved you in Pocahontas.
Thank you. I was really good in it.
I was. As you know...
I was really good in it.
You were Japtan Khan Cook.
I was not. I was Mulan.
This side rocks. This side of the table is amazing.
I was the cross-dressing Disney character.
So what I was going to say is, as you know, I am completely obsessed with you. I remember when you came to do our interview at Shetler Studios, we had never done an interview there, but we had to do it there because you had to get to Fun Home, which is much closer to Shetler Studios than Pearl, where we usually do our interviews. And I remember waiting for you. I used to see you around town all the time on your Razor scooter,
yeah.
And I would tweet about it. I'm like, in the West Village, saw Beth Malone scooting down 6th Avenue. She's got her helmet on. She's going to be fine.
Should there
be an accident, she's prepared.
I ripped my heel at the Tonys trying to wear girl shoes, and I had to buy a Razor scooter to let it heal, and it took 18 months for it to heal. So I was like, I'm not sure I'll ever walk again, right, or if I'll ever dance again, because I never was dancing anyway. But, you know, you need feet to be an actor, so, I mean, like,
not
you don't really need them, but if you're going to stand up on your feet a lot and walk around, you need them to both be working. So I was like, I couldn't have, if I was in any other show but Fun Home, I wouldn't have been able to go on. But I put, like, you know, one of those little donut things that looks like a little tiny toilet seat in on my heel. And I was like, I'm Allison, and I have a toilet seat in my shoe. So that was, you know, I was able to heal and continue to do the show. But the Razor scooter, that's why I was in the Razor scooter.
It's funny because it looks so authentic. Like, it looked like you were born on a Razor scooter. Because, well, I remember you getting off the elevator, you're, like, carrying it. You had, like, your helmet and your, like, your messenger bag. I was like, well... I'm obsessed with her.
I got really good at it.
Yeah.
I got really good at it. I got really good at breaking it down. I could go, chunk, 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 and then, like, carrying it like a suitcase. And then, you know who taught me is the Fun Home kids, because they all had them. Like, Sydney Lucas, she was the first person I ever saw with a Razor scooter, and she was like, you have to do this, you have to do that. So I was like, okay, thank you, schooling me, you know.
Can I re-ask you a question I asked you in our first Theater People interview? The question I asked you was, like, how is it for you to be a lesbian and get to play a lesbian in such a celebrated show that went on to win the Tony Award? It's so incredibly groundbreaking. And you were kind of like, it's cool.
Well,
do you still feel that way, or has it deepened since you have left?
Well, you know, my whole impulse is to always normalize it, so that to be, like, flippant about it is my way of trying to say, yes, and what else is about? You know, because the lesbian part of it ends up being the most important part of it for a lot of people, and really, it's broad. It's more broad than that. What it's about is more universal than that. So I kept trying to reach beyond the specificity of being a lesbian tale, and you know, reach out and make it everyone's story. And I think that it ultimately does do that, but Allison has a butch gender identity, or something like more androgynous gender identity, and so I think that is vital to why it was sort of powerful to be the first one.
Yeah.
Because you know, when you think leading lady, you don't you know, often, like, it was so funny. Here's an anecdote that will tell you where we're at. We're at the Tonys, right? Cerveris, Sydney, and me are sitting in the house, and a stage manager walks up and goes, what show are you with? What show are you with? I'm like, because everyone else was, like, wearing feathers and spangles and blah, blah, blah. And they're like, what show? And they thought I was, like, a stage manager, you know, and I was like, here's my headset and my Leatherman. Like, But you know, I was like, "We're fun home," and Michael goes, "No, we are fun home." And she goes, "You're fun. Oh my god, I'm sorry." So that's
Will you tell the story that you told yesterday during the LGBT panel? That was so funny about the difference between boys going to rehearsal. Oh, and Andrew, will you do what you did when she told that story?
No, I mean, I just sweat, you know, you had asked, like, what it was like to, you know, make a show with, you know, lesbians as the center of it. And I had said this. I said, when you're a gay man, you know, in the theater, when you walk into rehearsal, it's like Grindr. Because, you know, you walk in and you're like, and for women, it's so not like that. When a gay woman walks into rehearsal, you know, there are a bunch of just like glamorous, lovely, gorgeous women whose job it is usually to be really appealing. And, you know, although I'm very open to learning about them, I would never be, I'm never going to be in that tribe. But they're very kind to me and very, very, you know, they pat me on the head a lot. But I'm never going to be, but I've pretended to be one of them a lot in my career. But I, you know, I'm not, but Fun Home was different because I was like, Lisa Crone. And I was like, Roberta. You know, it was like, this is fun. It's fun to go to work and have, like, queer girls. This is, like, unheard of, except for, like, usually, like, oh, someone's up in the, you know, the spot. Yeah, it's like, oh, I see a dyke. And I can spot him. I mean, sometimes when I go to get mic'd up, I'm like, is she for me? Did you send her to give me my mic because you know I'd like her? Is that why? And oftentimes the answer is yes.
I just one other thing. You're redoing Unsinkable Molly Brown. This was just announced. Oh my god. Yes. It's gonna be at the Muni this summer, right?
What?
It's gonna be at the Muni, right?
Yeah, the Muni, yeah.
And tell us everything. Dick Scanlon like rewrote the music, is that right?
Yeah, he pulled a bunch of, well, he didn't rewrite the music. He rewrote lyrics to some of the songs, and he pulled Trunk songs from Meredith Willson's Trunk, and he wrote lyrics that are for different situations in the show that now exist because he rewrote the book. Is anyone really familiar with The Unsinkable Molly Brown? The book is
kind of a mess.
Right? The book is thin, and it's really, there's a lot there about the actual Molly Brown that is far more interesting than what's in the play, and engaging and real, and she's actually, you know, a political activist and a feminist, and, you know, she's a suffragette, and she wanted to arm women and send them out to fight next to men in the military. Like, she had a bunch of amazing ideas. She was the smartest person in any room she was in. She spoke six languages. She was self-taught. She was a force of nature. And unlike Alison Bechdel, who is also the smartest woman in any room she goes into, she leads with her, like, shoulders. And she's all action, action, action. She makes a lot of mistakes and things like that. And she has a lot to say. So unlike Fun Home, where I spoke nary a word. So it's really fun, and it's a joy bomb, and I'm so excited to get to do it again because it is going to be like exercising a lot of pain that we're all in right now, yeah. I feel.
I wanted to just say, lastly, my daughter at this point could probably sing all of the words to Maps and Telephone Wire because we just listen to them on a loop while we make fish sticks for dinner.
I think it's so funny when little kids sing Maps.
Yeah.
It's funny. This, I don't know why it strikes me so funny.
She used to also do the, when we would listen to the Skylar Sisters, you know, the part where you go, well, Daisy would literally go, woo! That was her favorite thing to do. Yeah. I'm going to have to do this part like this if you don't mind. Hi, Celia Keenan-Bolger. I can't talk to you. You guys, it's Celia Keenan-Bolger.
Hi.
I'm so sorry that I exist.
What are you talking about? I also don't want to make your 100th episode a very special dead mom episode, but I also just want to say that theater saved my life after my mom died, and that the number of women who I got to have play my mother when I didn't have a mother myself was deeply moving for me and healing in a way that I think theater, you know, we all have ideas of why it's important to attend and to be a part of the theater, but I think for myself, like, that is it's not lost on me.
Yeah.
How lucky I am.
Yeah, God. So I waited like forever to ask you to be on Theater People the first time because I was so afraid you would say no. And I remember when you said yes, I got on Facebook and I was like, oh my God, you guys, she said yes, she said yes, she said yes. And then when we were waiting for you to get off the elevator, I was like, I'm shaking. And then you got off the elevator and I'm just obsessed with you. And I'm sorry that I have to tell you that 10 times every time I see you. Although the more embarrassed it makes you, the more I want to tell you. you both are like super activists. And so we live in this bubble of BroadwayCon over the weekend. All I know is that like yesterday at 4 o'clock when we were doing our LGBT panel, that crazy man signed some crazy shit and then everybody went to JFK. Like, it's crazy out there. And then you had a panel this morning that I was popping into and out of because I wanted to hear what you had to say about artists and the responsibility of, like, or whatever, just, like, what we can do, what you can do. What's happening, girl? Tell us what to do.
I mean, I don't right know. I know for myself, I think what I've been so moved by here at BroadwayCon is all are welcome. And I think the people who consume theater and the people who make theater are some of the most empathetic people in this country. And that we have enormous power in that. And figuring out, even if it's, and I think, you know, I think the political is personal. And the way that we interact with one another, the way we treat the person who rings us up at a cash register, the way that we treat someone who sweeps our floor, the way we treat our next door neighbor is political. And I think right now it's easy to feel really bogged down in what to do. And I think what I'm trying to do is figure out what is inside of me that I know is, and I encourage all of us to do this. It's like, what am I good at? And if you don't like to be in big crowds at a protest, that's totally fine. If you don't like to make phone calls, that's totally fine. But you have something in you. Maybe you like, you're super organized. I'm going to tell you, there are a lot of nonprofits that could use your help for you to come in and help organize their books. Or maybe you only like to deal with one person at a time. You could be a big sister or a big brother to someone. I think it's really digging deep and saying, what do I have inside of me that is special and that I know I excel at? And then using that towards the cause. And I think that's really different for everyone. I mean, I think what I've been hearing is that it's helpful to find one thing that you care the most about and put your efforts there. I'm having a really hard time coming up with that one thing for the moment.
Because you have a lot.
I do. But I'm also just, I saw this, our attorney general in New York is named Eric Schneiderman. Follow him on Twitter. He's amazing. And he said something, and he was like, we're in new territory, and so we need to throw ourselves against a lot of walls and see what sticks. And you find your cause, and then you find your people, and then you go forth. And if you fatigue, you know that you have other people around you who will take the reins for a little bit, and then you can take a step back, and then when you get your mojo back, you go forth. And I think that is really good advice.
Yeah, I had a friend on Twitter today that was saying, like, her strategy is to work really hard every other day.
Yeah.
You know?
Or take the weekends off.
Yeah.
Or, you know, do one thing a week. But I was just having a conversation with a friend, and she was like, I feel I'm consuming so much news, I'm so informed, but I don't know what to do. Yeah. And I think a lot of us feel that way. And I think getting in rooms, I had like a post-election grief gathering where I was like, I'm not even here to talk about what to do. I'm here to bring people I care about together and to say, why are we so sad? Like, why do we feel the way that we feel about what just happened? And I think something as basic as that, getting the people that you care about into a room and saying, how are we doing and what are we doing? And I think surrounding myself with the people that I love in the community, particularly this theater community, has been very motivating.
Yeah. And I just want to add, the thing about being in a bubble, you know, I think that words are important. Language forms how we think about the world. And I feel like we're all saying about each other that we're in bubbles. And I think that that's really a false picture of where we are, because especially in New York City or Los Angeles or San Francisco or Chicago, where we live in these extremely diverse metropolises, I mean, if you look at this room, this is not a bubble. We are exposing ourselves all the time to different perspectives and different classes and races and experiences, and I think that's really important to recognize. That even if your Facebook feed or your Twitter feed is sort of, you know, confirming your beliefs and that's all you're seeing, you're still surrounded by people who have very different perspectives. Even if politically you share a lot of perspectives, we are all very different. And I think that's different than people who live in places that are really only surrounded by people who look and think exactly like them.
Yeah.
So we're not in a bubble.
I would also say it's as people who love to go to the theater, and I include myself in that group, but as particularly with this BroadwayCon audience, I would just really encourage you to see theater where the people don't look like you. Because the stories that are being told in the theater are so powerful and entertaining, and you will get a perspective that you don't have. And so I think that's a very basic way that you can be political. You can support theater that by people who don't look like you.
Just a quick question. Celia and Daisy, did you guys go to high school together for a minute?
Oh, thanks for asking.
Oh, funny you should ask. We went to junior high school together for a hot minute.
How on earth did that come to be?
Well, we went to...
Daisy Egan turned down a role to be in a movie, and then
no,
I was...
No, it was a play, wasn't it?
But you did... You turned down the play. Yeah, right. You turned down the play to be in a movie, I think. Losing Isaiah?
Oh, sure.
And so I was... I was...
It was a play about Jewish children who were being carted off to...
Not Jewish.
Jewish. To England, kinder transport. It was about the children who were escaping the Nazis. So it was a comedy. And And I had to turn it down, and Cece came in, and I don't even
but
know if
you like
to be called
that.
But it
was also a very, I mean, this is sort of, this might be embarrassing for you, Daisy, again, but I was, like, genuinely probably more obsessed with Daisy Egan than almost anyone in the Broadway community, because I was obsessed.
I will confirm that fact.
Truly, the number of times that I watched that Broadway baby performance at a Sondheim celebration at Carnegie Hall, if you haven't seen it, you must revisit
it. Didn't you try to get out of that?
No, I was standing backstage and I was so terrified that I asked them if we could cancel the number. At
She's
Carnegie
incredible.
Hall stand, like while they're playing the intro. I was like, can we not? And they were like, go.
But it was one of the first times I was ever faced with like this, you know, girl from Michigan going to, they were like, you know, you're going to go to high school here. And then I was like, you guys, it's Daisy Egan. And just trying to be like, don't ruin this.
Well, it's funny because we had some sort of like fakakta like recital or some garbagey thing at that school, and you got up and sang Kiss Today Goodbye, and I was like,
my career is over.
So. I want to ask you guys about, I think this is maybe a good thing to do. What is something that inspires you?
My son.
Yeah. Talk about that kid for a minute.
Oh, he's the best.
Yeah. Will you do your impression of him? Do the one when you call him from Dallas.
Oh. So I travel a lot, and we travel a lot, and his favorite thing to do when I get on the phone with him is he says, Mama, where are you? So I was traveling, and I Skyped him from Dallas, and he said, Mama, where are you? And I said, I'm in Dallas. And he goes, Dallas? I love Dallas! That kid loves everything.
He's the best.
Like,
he's the best.
We were going into the basement at the theater, and he said, "Where are we going?" And one of my friends said, "We're going to the basement." And he literally goes, "The basement! I love basements!"
You're so screwed.
I'm screwed. He plays the drums. When I take him to Halloween, first of all, he calls it trickle treating. Playdle, Legles, He's amazing. And he, when I take him trick-or-treating, he says, "Trick or treat, please." And then when he gets his treat, he says, "Thank you, my friend." And this is not me coaching him. I don't believe in, like, line readings. I don't. I'm like, go be yourself. And he's
I feel like he thinks it's 1920.
He does. You know he's like, well, thank you, sir.
Yeah.
Well, we'll have a Tootsie Roll.
Kay Alicetto, what inspires you?
What inspires me?
Or just something that inspires you. Let's talk about something that makes us feel good.
Something that makes me feel good is when I can connect to whether it's one person or 100 or 1,000 when I sing a song. Because that's like when you were talking about how you have to find something inside of you, especially during these times, that you can use to not only get through it, but to make it better or somehow keep that hope going. And since that's happened, I've find that I connected more to something that I hated doing, which was, I hated singing growing up. I hated it.
Singing, oh, you hated singing
in
while
general,
you were
there. Yeah. Hated it. And somehow through all of this that's happened, it's helped me connect to a place where you can uplift people, and to see that and to be a part of that and to witness that is a gift that I could never have asked for and have been given. So I'm grateful for that. Very
can
grateful.
I ask you a question? When you were doing Hands on a Hard Body, you guys, your song was called Joy to the Lord, Joy of the Lord.
Yeah.
It was all
is that the last question?
No. There's an even deeper question than that.
Crap.
It's an a cappella song, and you had to hysterically laugh.
Yeah.
How did you ever?
It sucked.
Did you just fake it? How did you
so,
do it?
So, for a social anxiety disorder, stage 2 bipolar person who's standing by a truck, obviously doesn't really have a good self esteem about themselves ever, and I'm on this stage in the middle of nowhere, dead silence, and all I have is the key, like one key of G note playing on a loop on my CD player that I then have to stop while I'm laughing, so that I have that correct key because it starts a cappella. And I have to make sure everybody else on that truck is in that same key as well, so that once we pull out of that drum beat or whatever we were doing, that we're on the same key with the band. Yeah, it sucked.
Wow.
It sucked a lot. I sweated to death every time I did it. I nearly choked to death every time I did it because I had to make sure everybody was laughing with me. And I don't even know where it came from, but I did it.
And you got a Tony nomination
That's
for
fine,
it.
That's fine. I'll take it. Whatevs. Thank you.
Hi, Beth Malone. What inspires you? And don't say me. That's embarrassing.
You.
Thank
you.
You. Thank you.
I'm sitting up here with all you guys, and, you know, artists inspire me. I love rehearsal so much. I love watching people wrestle with things and put themselves out there and crack themselves open in a vulnerable way in front of other people. I love the quest, the theatrical question. I love getting in a room with people and doing the work. I love rehearsal. Rehearsal inspires me. And, you know, mountains.
And mountains, yeah.
You know, I love to go outside. Being outside is really important to me. I'm from Colorado, so, you know, it's always, living in New York is always like a bit of a vice. You know, I can feel the pressure building until I can get out, and then I feel like a lot better. And then I come back and I have a resource, a well of you know, goodwill for a time, and then it crushes down on me and I have to get out again. So, I'm not a city person.
I have one quick question for you. Oh, wait, please talk.
No, I just want to say that Judy Kuhn told me a story that when Beth was doing...
Not Pocahontas, by the way.
No, not Pocahontas.
Not to be confused
that
with.
That would be Judy Kuhn.
That when Beth was doing Fun Home, on Sunday nights, she would take the red eye to Aspen. She would ski all day Monday and come back on Tuesday and do the show at night.
I had a Broadway salary at that point. So I was able to be like, I need to go skiing. Yeah, it's true, though. But, I mean, I really, really love it. I have this...
obviously.
Desperate, desperate love for theater, but also I have a desperate, desperate love for, like, going downhill fast on things.
I have one question for you. Yeah. So I got to be with you this on your second-to-last performance of Fun Home. You let me come and sit with you in your dressing room to interview you for
and
that
Judy
other
Kuhn's
podcast.
Dressing room. Judy
oh, my God. She walked in, and I dropped my recorder. I'm not cool, you guys. I don't handle things well. So... I was thinking about how it was the I had never been backstage at a Broadway show so close to closing, and the energy was unbelievable. I could feel it. And I was thinking about how you have the, after this incredibly emotional final song, you have a line. Your last line, I believe, is something like, there were moments, incredible moments where he soared above me or something like that. How did you, I know your goal was to stay in the moment until the very last chord played out and to not lose it. Did you accomplish that goal?
The thing, Sam Gold is really amazing about keeping us on the front foot. He always says front foot. And that is to not wallow in anything. And the thing about the job of Allison in life is that she was just like searching and trying to nail down something. Emotions are coming and going, whatever they are, but it's not what it's about. So it's about saying and identifying the thing, naming the thing, so that she can put it to rest, so she can move beyond it. So it's always about doing it, and it was really good, just like good, solid, like intention-based acting. It was like just keep playing the actions, and that's all it was. But I have to say, even having said all that, it was like 6 months into the run before I could sing that final trio with any voice that anyone would want to hear, because the rest of it was just like just like trying to get tones out over like this constricting sob that's in your, you know, body. So I feel like Janine came back, you know, toward, you know, the middle of the run, and she was like, wow, you're really singing good. I'm like, yeah, I can sing the show without bawling now, so thanks for writing that.
Celia yeah. Keenan-Bolger, what inspires you?
This is maybe going to make you want to punch me in the face, but I'm
going
to say...
That would never, ever happen.
I'm going to say my siblings.
Yeah.
It's like... I tried to think of something better. I can't.
I sat down with your sister yesterday. I've told you both this story that I used to do research in the LGBT archive in the New York Public Library. It's too long of a story to tell. Maggie helped organize that because she's awesome. And I remember seeing her name at the bottom of it and being like... That's a Keenan. That has to be a Keenan-Bolger. This is like before everybody knew Maggie and before, you know what I mean? But like, I was like, that. How do they do everything in this town? There's so many of them. They're so good at everything. All right, Andrew, you can't say siblings. She already said it.
I mean, I was going to say my sister Maggie. I think she, I know it's cheating. No, but for real perspective. A lot of people are like, oh, where's Maggie, the third Keenan-Bolger? And I'm like, first of all, she's the second Keenan-Bolger. I'm the third one. But I think that she has been the one who has best taken our parents. They were really big hippie activists, like laid down on train tracks, have criminal records. And
yes.
Badasses. Also commies, too. Kind of cool.
Yes.
Like after it was popular.
Socialist.
Yeah, socialist. Right. Really? Amazing. And
you're all going to jail.
Yikes. And she has taken our parents' sort of political tendencies and fused them with art. And she has this nonprofit theater called Honest Accomplice Theater that produces...
Woohoo!
Yeah, Honest Accomplice fans. That produces theater for women and trans people. They just did a play recently about the female body. They produced a web series about trans literacy. And she is really doing the good work of taking art and using it as a tool for social change. And I think that's so inspiring. And then the other thing that I would say that inspires me is youth in America right now. I think we are taking this generation for granted. The kids who have been protesting at the mm-hmm. Women's March, holding signs like, if you build that wall, my generation will come and knock it down.
Yeah.
The kids who on Trump's inauguration organized a school walkout in middle school.
Wow.
That's insane. And just the fact that, like, now growing up with Celia having a kid, and William doesn't No, he'll go talk to anyone. He'll go see a woman wearing a hijab. He'll go see a black man on the elevator. It doesn't matter. Like, that is truly learned behavior, and I believe that our youth are smart enough and have enough access to the news and the internet to not buy into the bullshit that their parents are telling them.
Yes. Daisy Egan, Kay Alicetto, Beth Malone, Celia Keenan-Bolger, Andrew Keenan-Bolger, I love you all so much. Thank you for doing this. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Theater people turned 100 right before your very eyes. Woohoo!
I'm just a Broadway baby.
So that was it. We turned 100 episodes old. All right, you guys, I have to make one pitch. If you love Theater People Podcast, we'd be so honored if you'd consider supporting us via our Patreon page. For as little as $1 per month, you can help keep us going and growing, and you get great rewards for doing so. You can go to patreon.com and search for Theater People Podcast, or you can go to our website, which is theater with an ERPPL.com, and click the Patreon link. We never could have gotten to 100 episodes without the support of Vanya Arslanian, our original producer, and Mike Jensen, who came on as a producer quickly thereafter. I love you both so, so much. Also, a special lovey-dovey shout-out to my handsome husband, Steve Tipton, the most supportive man on the planet. Special thanks also to Bradley Bean, Eric Emsch, Keith Allen Herzog, our Patreon associate producers, Robbie Roselle, Ty Williams, and Cynthia Wallach, and to my other great love, Ellen Marsh, and of course, the staff at Oswald's. Here's to 100 more episodes, you guys. We'll see you next Monday for our interview with Sunset Boulevard's leading man, Michael Xavier. Until then, tell your friends about us. Let's get the theater community talking.
Only what I got, plus a tube of grease paint and a follow spot. I'm just a Broadway baby, slaving at the 5 and 10, not dreaming of the great day when I'll be in a show. Broadway, baby, making rounds all afternoon, eating at a greasy spoon to save on my dough. At my tiny flat, there's just my cat, bed and a chair. Still, I'll stick it till I'm on a bill all over Times Square.
Broadway, baby.
If I stick it long enough,